Welcome to the Pride of Detroit podcast, PODcast. Take two here, as this one comes out on a Wednesday. The original recording we started had us screaming at Jeremy Reisman because he used trickery to fill our review inboxes with plenty of new stuff. We are here. It's coming out a day late because we had to re-record this. That's the short end all of the story. So this is the only re-recorded segment you are going to hear is segment number one, which is going to be about Taylor Decker. We talked on Monday about Jeremy Macklin and Joseph Fourier, and we interviewed Tex Western from Acme Packing Company, kind of preview the Green Bay Packers and what they did in the draft and in free agency to get you up to speed when the Lions play them in the season. And we do the mailbag. But that was all done on Monday. We had to come back in here and chop out about a quarter of this because big news broke on Tuesday that we felt like we've had this before on the podcast. I'll introduce everyone real quick before I continue. I'm Chris Lemieux, at Adequate Host, The Adequate Host, Jeremy Reisman, at Detroit Online, and Ryan Matthews at, you know, I can't even do the drop because we're just kind of crunch for time. Ryan Matthews, the rock god, at Ryan_POD. Guys, we've had this happen before, though, on the podcast, where we record a part and then news breaks like a day later or later in the day, and we are just left for a week before we can dissect it on the POD cast.
Monday was a simpler time, Chris. I remember it like it was yesterday.
It was a lot simpler, and the outlook for the Lions probably a lot more positive, and that's all out the window. Taylor Decker, Lions starting left tackle, drafted in 2016, looked to be, for the most part, the linchpin of this offensive line going into 2017. He's hurt. He's hurt bad. He underwent surgery on Monday, probably while we were recording the podcast, the PODcast. And now it's Tuesday, and because I dragged my heels on editing audio, we did not put it out in time. Like, I was like about ready to work on editing the last part, and the news broke that Taylor Decker had head surgery on his shoulder.
Wait, what? I thought we were re-recording the podcast to talk about Matt Stafford being on the top 100.
He's number 31, I believe, in the NFL top 100. No, we're here to talk about Taylor Decker.
What happened to Taylor Decker?
Are you playing Overwatch again? I just said what happened to Taylor Decker.
No, I'm just in denial. It's one of the stages.
One of the stages of grief? Yeah, no.
It's been a rough day at Pride of Detroit. I think we're all still kind of reeling from the news, and we all don't quite know how to react, which is, I think, why it's good that we're here together to hash this out with each other and with our listeners.
I feel nothing.
Well, you're not a Lions fan. It's fine.
That's the joke.
I've been trying to spin this and, you know, work any sort of mental gymnastics to myself to figure out what the silver lining is here, or, you know, why this isn't a disaster. And there's not really a lot coming to me. I mean, it's not like the Lions 2017 season is over or anything, but this is just about the worst news I think that the Lions could get at this point in the season outside of Matthew Stafford getting seriously hurt. Am I wrong?
I mean, what else? I'm trying to think of like a single player, but then I look on the defense and I'm like, I don't really know who's that one player I can take away from the defense that would make it crumble. The defense is all still kind of bad. Taylor Decker, though, like, it's, oh man.
Darius Slay. If you take away Darius Slay from the cornerback position, I think it gets way too thin beyond that because you don't have a true number one.
Sure. Before we get into too many speculatives, though, we should probably give a timeline of the events for those who don't know. So, again, Tuesday is when I'm kind of let's not work backwards. Let's work in chronological order. So Taylor Decker, I believe last week he was at OTAs and he has apparently injured his shoulder then. We don't know how. OTAs are all non-contact by nature. So that leaves the door, but Jim Caldwell on Tuesday did not specify whether it was a contact or non-contact injury, or maybe he injured it
something off the field completely. We don't know.
And to be clear, non-contact means non-contact with other players. They're still like hitting sleds, right, that sort of stuff. So,
yeah,
you know, we're still not sure whether it was something like that or, like you said, just completely non-contact at all.
Right. Monday, he undergoes surgery. Tuesday, Jim Caldwell addresses the media and explains that Taylor Decker won't be at practice. He had surgery yesterday, and the only news about his availability or whether he'll even be back is just basically same old Lions stuff. I didn't mean to use that phrase, but it's the Lions being the Lions in the fact that there's no damn details. We're supposed to get an update around training camp, and that's all we've been given.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much the only thing Caldwell said is he's not going to be at the rest of OTAs. He's not going to be at mandatory minicamp next week. So that gets us through next week, and then the rest is completely unknown.
Yep, we don't know. We don't know, and like I think you laid it out in an article today, Jeremy. Probably the most, I mean, I think the way they go from here is they put him on the physically unable to perform list, right? The PUP list?
Yeah, that seems like the... It basically, if they do that, it doesn't preclude that Decker's going to miss any extended time necessarily. It kind of gives them a lot of options. If you put Decker on IR right now, he's out for the season. Yeah. I know you're thinking he could be one of those two positions that come back for the regular season after 6 weeks. That's not how it works.
He's got to be put on IR during the season itself.
Exactly. Once week one starts, that Monday of week one leading up to week one, if you get cut then, or I'm sorry, if you get put on IR then you can come back in 6 or 8 weeks, depending on how long. But IR now means he's done for the season, so they're not going to do that, I would guess. Again, we don't know how serious of an injury this is, but Jim Caldwell did say he didn't think it was going to end his season. So if that's the case, definitely don't think it's going to cost him. They're definitely not going to put him on IR.
Granted, though, Caldwell's not a great judge of this kind of stuff. I remember last year he was very optimistic about when DeAndre Levy would come back. And as we saw, DeAndre Levy, like, he's like, oh, yeah. Like, we expect to have DeAndre Levy available, and what happened?
He came back.
Eventually. Like, I think that's where a lot of people are putting him, is going to be probably a mid-season return at this point. But honestly, we don't know. We don't know how bad it was on the shoulder, what it was. What were you Googling all day today, Ryan?
What was I Googling all day today? I was Googling potential shoulder injuries that would...
I thought it was a specific, like, torn labrum or something.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking into, like, rotator cuff stuff. I was looking into torn labrums. I was talking to friends who had torn labrums. I was basically scouring the earth. There was actually an article I found that was all about, like, offensive linemen and the kind of stress, depending on their body type, the kind of stress that gets put on their shoulders. It was way too scientific to go into detail, and I didn't read nearly enough of it to talk about it at length. But some of the things that I've read, and they've been kind of kicked around a little bit on the Twitterverse, was torn labrums usually take between 4 to 6 months, because they have to actually go in there, take the muscle, reattach it to the bone. And the bone and the muscle have to fuse back together, and that usually takes a good chunk of time. And then after that, and that can take anywhere from like 2 to 3 months. And then after that, you have rehab, and rehab takes at least a month to get your strength back up. And that's, I mean, I'm guessing that might even just be for a normal person. You're talking about an NFL athlete here too, so
kind of hardworking one at that.
Right, exactly. So I mean, obviously it's all conjecture and it's all speculation, but with the Lions and the way that they handle injuries, we're kind of left to do just that. We don't really have any of their options. We're not going to know anything about Taylor Decker. We probably won't ever find out about what his injury really is until
he accidentally leaks it on like a YouTube podcast.
Like just stay, stay glued to all of like Taylor Decker's social media. Try to figure out that way.
Does he have a Snapchat?
He has a Twitter.
Ooh, I don't think he has a Snapchat. We'll check. Damn. I'll double check that.
We've broke stuff off Snap before. So.
That's true. I think the general gist though to take is one, he got surgery, which shows you how serious this is. Two, this is his shoulder, which is a key component of an offensive lineman, obviously. So I think at this point I would be shocked if he's ready for week one.
I think that's out of the question.
I mean, it's possible, but I just think it's unlikely at this point. I'm not a doctor. I don't have any inside resources, but this screams to me at least a 2 to 3 month rehab, and that puts us right at the beginning of the season.
The other thing is rewatching Jim Caldwell's presser, because I wasn't watching it in real time. I was actually writing a letter to Pernell McPhee about how he needed to stop talking badly about our quarterback. And then I find out right when I get done with it that Taylor Decker is injured. But when I went to go rewatch the presser with Jim Caldwell, he mentioned, like, it was a very slow build to how long he would be out. It was like, well, you know, he's going to miss the rest of this week. Then he's going to miss the rest of next week. And then we're going to let you know how he's doing in the fall. It's like, oh, okay. So 3 months, we'll figure out how he's doing in 3 months. Okay, this is pretty serious.
I mean, I don't know about serious. It's just this is how the Lions operate. They just don't tell you anything, and it's just getting...
Well, I mean, it's serious in that the injury is going to be severe, and it's going to cost him. It's going to cost him the entire offseason. And I think that's crucial. I mean, people want to talk about how already great Taylor Decker was, and how Chris, you mentioned he's the linchpin of the offensive line. Jeremy mentioned that outside of Matthew Stafford, he was the player that the Lions could least afford to lose. Taylor Decker could not afford to miss out on all of this stuff that was going on in the offseason. Like, players' trajectories aren't always upward. Like, it's not always like a upward trajectory, like, through the years. It's not like you're playing Madden and the guys just continually get better until they reach their potential. Like, there can be regression in there. Like, this is real life. Like, making the jump from year one to year two, Bob Quinn talks about how that's so important with all of his athletes. And he says he reevaluates players based on that second year. Decker's now behind the eight ball.
I mean, we don't need to go far away from the team to get an example of this. We're going to find out very soon about the same thing, because look what, I mean, Amir Abdullah missed his sophomore year. And, you know, now if we have a second player who's a second top two round player from the last few drafts who's going to miss his sophomore year, it's not a great sign for some of the young guys here. Like, I don't know. I think when it comes to Decker, he was so far ahead in 2016. I'm not going to worry too much about it. But as you say, like, you just don't know. You just don't know. I mean, when it comes down to it, I'm not going to say this is football thing, like, stranger things have happened. It's sports. Like, we don't really, like, you can't just put these things out entirely. As you say, Ryan, it's not a video game where just, you know, you collect these guys and they gain XP points and they just go up and up and up.
And I think what may worry me the most is, like, you look at, like, I did a deep dive today on some offensive tackles that are still available, and you just see, like, how injury-riddled offensive linemen can be. And I know Taylor Decker's coming off a season where he didn't miss a single snap, but you just kind of have to wonder, with shoulder being such a crucial part to the position, like, is this going to be the beginning of one of those careers that you know, every single year something pops up? There's really no indication of that happening yet, but this is football. That's what happens with a lot of offensive linemen. You just kind of hope that either they don't rush Decker back, or this is kind of a smaller issue than we're making out to be. You just never know, though.
And that's kind of the problem when we don't have any of these details from the Detroit Lions. All right, you kind of touched on it, though, just to kind of put a bow on this and move on to the rest of the podcast, though. Like, what's the options here for the Lions? Because we got to be worried. Like, you know, we can talk about Decker's future all we want, but I think most people are going to be worried about the immediate future for the Lions, the 2017 season, which again puts them without a left tackle, you know, kind of the anchor of that offensive line. So what are the options for the Lions?
Why don't you kick this off, Ryan, since you talked about the in-house options, and I'll talk about some of the free agents.
Okay, for sure. So I do have an article up on prideofdetroit.com that you can check out. But for your audio privileging ears, I will talk about the in-house options. So the Lions have, obviously, Rick Wagner, who they signed to a mega deal, but he is going to be the least likely option to move over the left side. I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that he's going to stay on the right.
I think Caldwell's already said he's staying right tackle.
Mm-hmm, yep, so Caldwell indicated in his presser today that Wagner's going to stay at right tackle. So that leaves your left tackle options that are in-house as Corey Robinson, who is currently not participating in OTAs because he's rehabbing from a foot injury that he suffered in Week 17 against the Packers. You have Cornelius Lucas, who was not healthy to begin last season, came on late, played very sparsely. He only really played if Reef was out and they were running those three tackle packages, so he kind of took over Robinson's spot, because for the majority of last year, it was Robinson came in for Reef, and he would also come in on those three tackle packages. And then the other option you have is Joe Dahl, who was the rookie guard drafted in 2016 in the fifth round out of Washington State. It's pretty well documented that Joe Dahl didn't play very much. He actually didn't see the field until the Dallas game, where he came in for Laken Tomlinson, who was, I think he was benched that game, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah,
he played about 20 snaps, I think, in all last year. Dahl did?
Yep. I think he played 11 in the Cowboys game, then he played 9 the next week. So yeah, 20 snaps. But the thing with Joe Dahl that we found out back in January was from a Michael Rothstein report from ESPN, the beat writer who covers the Lions. He talked about Joe Dahl and him getting acclimated to the NFL and how it was such a steep learning curve just because he was trying to learn how an NFL offense works, like all the intricacies that go in to playing offensive lines. So when Alex and I were at training camp last year, Joe Dahl was a guy who impressed us. I think his ability to move, a lot of people were kind of knocking his athleticism, but I thought he was a guy who seemed like he moved pretty well amongst all of the other linemen that were at training camp last year. So it seems like last year was such a learning period and such a learning experience for him that his football IQ had to catch up to his athletic ability. And now maybe hopefully we're getting to that point. I don't think, obviously, that he should be the number one option to play left tackle.
Yeah, and I know from like Dave Burkett, he made observations last week that Joe Dahl was kind of taking those snaps at left tackle. We'll have to see if that's just temporary or it doesn't really mean much at this point. Jeremy, real quick, we've only got like a couple minutes here, but what are the outside options? You know, the Lions just got about like what, close to $5 million from the levy cap, and tell me what, like, as you said, it's injury prone.
Right, they have about $10.5 million to spend if they want to, and it seems like, I don't know if they really want to, because even though Joe Dahl is kind of like a long shot, especially since he's more physically in tone with being like a guard, there are some options out there on the free agent market. And I went through, like Ryan, I have an article up today on Tuesday about some options. Most of them are just kind of like 30 plus aging guys who are on the verge of retirement with huge injury histories. The good news here is, though, is that kind of fits what the Lions need, like not the injury riddled stuff, but they just need like a stopgap replacement here. So a guy, it doesn't matter if this is going to be this guy's last season in his career. So we're talking about guys like Will Beatty, who's with the Giants for, I think, 11 or 12 years, but he's had a myriad of injuries. He's had a foot injury, broken leg, disrupted sciatic nerve in his back, a torn pectoral, rotator cuff, a detached retina, like literally a laundry list of injuries. A lot of people are interested in Ryan Clady. That's another guy. He was a Pro Bowler a few years ago. Again, 31 years old, rotator cuff surgery, shoulder surgery, all sorts of it. Like Liz Frank, ACL. These are all just one guy. I think maybe the most interesting option is King Dunlap. He also has a few injuries, like all of these guys. But he signed a 4-year, $28 million deal just 2 years ago. And then the Chargers went out and signed Russell Okung this offseason, cut him. There's also a strange domestic issue with him. There's no domestic violence or anything, but he essentially was arrested back in, I want to say, February for violating what is basically a protective order, which was, you know, like a glorified restraining order, essentially. But the charges were dropped. His lawyer said it was a misunderstanding, so I don't know how big of an issue that is. The Lions would obviously do their thorough research before grabbing a guy like him.
Absolutely no reason why a lawyer would try to downplay any charges that are dropped.
Right.
Like, no goddamn reason. I mean, it's not like the Lions have been averse to grabbing guys who have charges.
Right.
So, but let's not try to spruce it up. The Lions aren't saints.
Right. But this also isn't a domestic abuse situation. It's a domestic, quote unquote, disturbance. Anyways, the guy...
The line's thin.
Yeah. Well, whatever. The guy started 12 games at left tackle with the Chargers last year, so he has recent experience. He rated like middle of the pack. I think it was 53rd best, according to Pro Football Focus. So he's not an outstanding guy. But again, Lions are just looking for a stopgap guy that can maybe play for half a season. And I think that would be an okay option. He might be a little bit expensive, though. We'll have to see what sort of money he's clamoring for. But in the end, I think the in-house options might be the best, because these are guys that are already popular with your system. I'm not sure you want to be throwing a lot of money at this position at this point in free agency. And you're going to need that money for Stafford and for other things next year.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We've got the rest of the podcast to get to. Again, we talked Monday. It feels odd saying it in the past tense. But we talked about Joseph Fourier. We talked about Jeremy Maclin. We hit up a really fun mailbag. Spoiler, did we talk about cars at all, Ryan? I don't remember.
I think we got a little bit.
Yeah,
in
we
there.
Talked about cars and mailbag.
Awesome. All right, we have all that coming for you and Tex Western. Stick around, that's coming up on the PODcast. Rolling right along here on the Pride of Detroit podcast, let's talk about a late development, and really one that came out of left field. The Kansas City, I don't know, Jeremy, you might argue this was kind of a little bit foreseen, or anyone who was keeping an eye on this, but I certainly wasn't. And that's just because I'm kind of in a hole during the offseason. But Jeremy Maclin was released by the Kansas City Chiefs on, what was it here?
Friday, I want to say. I think it was Friday.
I believe it was Friday, yeah.
Well, I was just, to your point, I think this was still a surprise to pretty much everyone. I think some Chiefs fans thought it was a possibility, being that it saved them $10 million in cap space. But one, it's weird timing because free agency is over, and that $10 million of cap space probably would have been a lot more valuable back then than it is now. And two, it's still a wildly unpopular move in Kansas City. I think Arrowhead Pride, the SB Nation site for the Chiefs, ran a poll, and it was like 70% of fans were not a fan of that move. So this was a surprise by pretty much everyone's standard, I think.
So with Jeremy Maclin on the market, it's kind of fascinating, and I think it's really fascinating too, because we're talking about, this is, if I'm just saying hypothetical, if the Lions want to make a run for it, they just got a bunch of money in the millions range that just got freed up because of the designation with DeAndre Levy. So they could if they wanted to, but I think you have already made the case that the Lions are probably not going to go after Jeremy Maclin because this receiver core is pretty well set.
I'm not going to stand here and say that Jeremy Maclin wouldn't make the Lions offense better. He absolutely, there's no question about it. The Lions could find a way to fix him in this offense, especially since he brings kind of a varied skill set. He can be that slot guy if the Lions want him to be that slot guy. He can move outside if they want to move Golden Tate inside. He's still 29 years old, which isn't extremely young, but it isn't old enough where, you know, he's done for his career. He has been going through some recent injuries, but he would make the team better. Yes. My sticking point, and it's one that I don't think you can get by, is that he's going to cost a lot of money. He's just coming off a contract, which he was going to be averaging $11 million per year. So we're at a stage in free agency where he might not be as expensive as he would have been if he was available back in March. But this is still a guy that's probably going to cost at least, I would say, $6 million a year. And the Lions only have about $10 million in cap space. To me, I think the Lions want to be carrying a little more than $4 million going into the season, just in case any sort of injuries happen. And because we've talked about it a little bit last year, sure, they're going to have a lot of cap space room next year because a lot of big contracts are coming off the books finally. But I think every dollar, every single penny that the Lions want, they're going to want every single penny, is what I'm trying to say, next year, because there's so many people who are going to become free agents. I think I did a calculation, 6 out of 11 projected starters on defense are going to be free agents next year, unless the Lions, you know, do some re-signing in this offseason. So I just think cost is the main sticking point here as to why Jeremy Maclin shouldn't be in a Detroit Lions jersey anytime soon.
So financial things aside, because I totally agree with you, first and foremost, Sherry, like I definitely agree that from a financial standpoint, I think that with what Maclin would bring to the table, it would only be like an incremental. I think you'd only see like an incremental upgrade based on the price that you'd have to pay. So beyond that, the Lions did run a lot of three wide receiver formation last year. Absolutely. So you can make the point that, well, you know, with the loss of Bolden, who had 101 targets last year, who's going to make up for all those targets?
Nice. We don't know if he's lost yet, though.
Right. And point. Yeah, I mean, the with the writing on the wall, we assume that Anquan Bolden's probably gone. But maybe that invitation might be out there while he figures some other things out. Even with that being said, yes. So the person who wants to bring in Maclin would hypothetically say, well, there's 101 targets to replace. Who's going to get all of those targets? They did spend draft capital on Kenny Golladay, and for, you know, take it for what it's worth, but he's lighting up OTAs and looking like the kind of guy that everybody, you know, could only dream for a third-round receiver who nobody had a whole lot of expectations of in the first place. He's lighting it up. You have other guys on the roster, too, like Jace Billingsley and TJ Jones. You have these guys who potentially, I mean, I foresee Jace making the team. I foresee potentially even TJ Jones making the team. One of those two guys is going to make it. One of those guys is still young. They're younger than Jeremy Maclin is. And I know Jeremy mentioned, you know, kind of at the stage of Macklin's career, he's a little bit injured. But what the point overall that I'm trying to make is that by bringing in a veteran like Jeremy Maclin, you are going to prohibit or you are going to slow down the progression of those other receivers. They're not going to get snaps. Therefore, they're not going to get in-game. They're not going to get in-game reps. And I think those are so very important to guys like Kenny Golladay, Jace Billingsley, potentially TJ Jones. You're going to inhibit their progression. And I think that last year it made sense with Bolden because these guys weren't expected to, they weren't anticipated to provide any kind of like real tangible, you know, production. Jace Billingsley was an undrafted rookie. TJ Jones, you know, we weren't even really sure. He got cut and came back. So I just think that those 101 targets, those will get spread out between Ebron. Tate could see some more, you know, targets. Marvin Jones, you know, dealt with injuries a little bit and missed a game. He could receive some extra targets. A lot of Bolden's work came in the red zone too, and that's where you figure Michael Roberts will get some targets. I am just not a big proponent of spending the money that it would cost to get Maclin, because I agree with Jeremy. Getting Maclin would be an upgrade. It 100% would be. He'd probably make the Lions wide receiving core one of the best, if not maybe the best in the NFC. But for the cost, that it would not only be financially, but in terms of the other players who could,
you know, stand to, you know, benefit from those reps. I don't like the fit at all. I really don't.
Yeah, and I almost completely agree there. I do feel like we tend to maybe overhype some of these fourth, fifth seed guys, you know, the Jared Aberderis, the Jace Billings, or the TJ Jones. Those guys are most likely replaceable, but there is a point to be made about developing these guys in home and potentially having them eventually take over like a wide receiver, like a number three wide receiver role, or, you know, if they somehow strike it rich once Golden Tate's, you know, in his 30s, late 30s, early 30s, whatever, you know, maybe that guy develops into a guy like Golden Tate. It's not exactly likely, but the more, like you said, you develop them in home, the better sense you get of who you have and the better taught these guys are in your system and you know, better capable to jump in there in case of injury as well. So, I mean, I get the excitement around a guy like Jeremy Maclin, but just realize that there are also 30 other teams that look at that guy and be like, wow. I mean, this guy could improve everybody's wide receiver core. There's no team that he wouldn't improve them at least a little bit, which means his value is probably going to be up there pretty high.
Yeah, it's just going to be really depending on who really at this stage of the game has the cap space to really go for him. I think the Lions kind of are in a, as you say, they could make it work, but he might be commanding enough that it's just not going to. They're in kind of a bad spot where it's like, okay, they've got some cap space, but probably not enough to really make to really pull the trigger if there is more teams in the mix for this.
Well, what about the other thing that we haven't even really talked about? We don't know enough about why Jeremy Maclin was even cut in the first place. Because if there's any team that would need a Jeremy Maclin, it would be the Kansas City Chiefs.
Yeah. It is. I mean, it's strange. They clearly didn't use him as much in 2016 as they did in 2015 when he had almost 1,100 yards. I think he only had, what, like 500 last year, and that's with missing a couple games, but not enough to get him back up to 1,100 yards. I know they drafted a couple guys, a couple wide receivers, and I think they were a little bearish on them, but in general, it's still a puzzling move. I mean, $10 million is a lot in cap space, but like I said, it's weird timing to want that cap space. There has to be something else going on there, and that's worth pointing out, Brian, because if someone's cutting a guy this late in the game, something weird's happening. Yeah.
So let's move on and talk about another guy who's out there now, and happy to see him back. Joseph Fourier. Am I saying his name right? Is it Fourier or is it Fourier?
I've been saying Fourier.
Fourier. It sounds more fancy if I do it like that. Joseph Fourier.
You got to say it with your pinky out.
Yeah. Fourier is back. He is attempting a comeback. Our favorite dancing man found out that, you know, he helped the NFL loosen its little iron appendage on celebrations. Now he's like, oh, okay. And now he is attempting a comeback. And I guess the question is, Lions?
It's a fun.
I mean, at this point, it's fun, I think. Yeah, it's. But I think at this point, I don't know. Jeremy, what do you have to say? Because I look at this tight end set, and I'm kind of thinking, I'm trying to figure out how to fit Fourier in here.
Yeah, and there's not really a way. And I brought it up in Pride Detroit this weekend just because he was back in Detroit, kind of hanging out with some old friends. Sam Martin's like his best friend. You guys remember he dressed up as Power Rangers. They dressed up as Power Rangers together for one Halloween. But yeah, I think he's been trying. If you follow him on Instagram, like I do as part of my job, but he's also kind of an entertaining follow. He's been working his ass off all offseason, and he has pretty much since he's been out of the league. And so I got a little excited just kind of seeing him there with Matthew Stafford hanging out, you know, they're wakeboarding or whatever. But like you said, it's hard to see a spot on this team for Joseph Fourier, especially after drafting Michael Roberts, because that's essentially the role he would play, except he doesn't quite bring the blocking that Michael Roberts brings. And I think that's ultimately the big sticking point with Fourier. If he could be that well-rounded guy, the guy that can block, that can come in and catch some red zone touchdowns, that'd be great. But he's pretty much only the latter there. He was never a good blocker in Detroit, and unless something drastically has changed now that he's been out of football for a couple years, there's just really no role for him in Michigan.
So with the whole celebration video that he made to help let everybody know what was now allowed and what is still disallowed, there was some news that came out about, you know, people in the organization that weren't so thrilled with his, like, touchdown celebrations and whatnot. Like, Jeremy, are you super familiar with that? Because I remember reading the story, but I don't remember the particulars, so...
Yeah, he joined, I think it was SiriusXM, talked a little bit about his time in Detroit and said that Jim Schwartz kind of pulled him aside after he did his first antics when he scored his first touchdown and was like, hey, you know, we don't do that here, blah, 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 like, we're professional. And then other teammates, I think including Kelvin Johnson, were like, dude, don't listen to him. Dance your ass off. Dance like nobody's watching. And so he did, like, he continued to dance, and he said even Jim Caldwell was a little... lukewarm on it, and he said he only got talked to twice about it, but
I know Caldwell dances.
No, he doesn't.
Yes, we do, dude. Jim Leland danced what did they do? Did they win the pennant when Jim Caldwell danced in 2012?
When Leland danced, yeah, it was when they won the pennant in 2012 when he did the moonwalk. Yeah.
Yep. So that just means the moonwalk and the finger guns. So that just means we need to just get Jim Caldwell to win an NFC North championship. No pressure.
I don't think you can compare those two at all.
He will dance. He will dance.
Leland is a badass. I love Leland because he's just like a cigar-smoking old cranky dude who's just like, I don't know. I have a ton of respect for that guy. Not that I don't for Jim Caldwell, but he's completely different.
We've seen pictures of Jim Caldwell in college. He was a spry young man. He's got that spirit in him. We just need to let it out of him.
Yeah, I mean, just because Jim Leland smokes darts and, like, orders probably a beer and a shot whenever he goes to the bar, everybody dances, man. Jim Caldwell dances. It might not be well, and it might not be often, but that man will dance.
I really hope 4AA can make that comeback, though. Like, I don't want to hear about immaturity. He was awesome. I liked him. I guess who would give him a shot, though, you'd think? Like, who out there is really hankering for a tight end?
You know, I'm wondering whether or not he just still, like, even if he does, you know, and hopefully he does make this comeback and hopefully he does land on his feet somewhere and end up on an NFL roster.
It's hard to make comebacks, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Definitely it is, especially a guy who, you know, had a very specific set of skills, not to, you know, turn him into Liam Neeson, but, like, I think if he ends up on any other NFL team, like, he would still serve that similar role as being, like, the red zone guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, next subject we're going to be broaching on is about a team that clearly does not need more tight ends because they just signed two in free agency. And that's a horrifying idea. This team went out and spent money in free agency? What? I'm talking about the Packers. And we are talking with Tex Western from Acme Packing Company next. Stick around. Welcome back to the Pride of Detroit podcast. In with us now from Acme Packing Company, it's Tex Western. Evan, quote unquote, Tex Western, but we just call him Tex. We like Tex. How you doing, Tex?
Doing good. It's still, what, 8 weeks until training camp? I'm beating my brain against the wall here, getting ready for some real football, but yeah, things are good.
You're not, are you ready for some football? Are you?
Yeah, you could say that. I got my rowdy friends here, by which I mean two cats hanging out on the couch near me, so...
Hank Williams Jr.'s weird ass aside, let's talk about the Packers.
Yes, let's. That's what I do best. Well, that's what people tell me. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, okay, so we did the Chicago Bears a couple of weeks ago. Now
I'm
it's
sorry.
On continuing our previews around the NFC North as we start to work through the Lions' schedule. We want to know about the teams as they change over the offseason. So let's go to the Packers today. And we actually have some free agents to talk about, which is shocking, I know. But I think we should start with a draft, which we'd like to do. So no first-round pick for the Green Bay Packers. Your first pick overall, Kevin King in the second round, cornerback out of Washington. Then Josh Jones, safety from NC State, deep in the second. Montrevious Adams, defensive tackle. Vince Beagle, linebacker out of Wisconsin, the fourth round. Jamal Williams, running back from BYU, who I actually kind of liked watching him in college. So what can you tell me about what the Pack really picked up this offseason?
Well, you could tell that obviously the defense was a major focus early on, with the first four picks being defensive players. And I think it's telling that they went at various different positions, too. The move back from the 29th pick to 33 to get Kevin King, I think it all worked out great because they added that pick where they got Vince Beagle in the fourth round to move back. And I think they still probably got the guy that they were looking for at 29 in the first place. They love King's measurables. He's a tall corner, which the Packers haven't really had in a long time. You know, he's 6'3", 200 pounds, but he's a tall, fast corner running, 4.42, 4.43, I think, and just blowing up the combine. I think that was certainly a big reason for why he was drafted as early as he was, but the Packers certainly have a good coaching staff in the secondary. Joe Witt has done some great things with some players with lesser skills and lesser pedigree than King. So it's an exciting thing from the standpoint of they filled some needs on defense for sure. Again, Vince Beagle is going to provide some good depth at linebacker, and certainly the hometown pick got everybody in Wisconsin real excited, especially after they missed out on TJ Watt. So that was definitely a winner. Josh Jones is an interesting guy because the more you see him in OTAs, the more we're kind of realizing he's playing a hybrid safety linebacker role, kind of that Deion Buchanan role from out in Arizona. So there's certainly some versatility there in these guys. King can play the slot, can play outside. Jones can play a couple of different positions. And then picking up a couple of running backs in the later rounds as well to provide some depth behind Ty Montgomery, a running back, I think that's going to be a real good move coming down the stretch. And you get a couple of different guys, too. Williams is a slasher. Aaron Jones in the fifth round is more of a scat back or receiving guy. So different skill sets, but certainly filling needs all across the board.
So you mentioned T.J. Watt, and I have to say, when the Packers were originally on the clock there at 29 and T.J. Watt was on the board, I thought it was pretty much a done deal. Were you kind of surprised that they didn't go with the hometown guy there?
Yeah, a little bit, especially because there had been... It looks now like it was more of a smokescreen, but there had been some rumors kind of connecting those two sides. And certainly the Packers seem to like guys that have some family history, Clay Matthews being one. There's some other guys in the roster that have a little bit of family pedigree in football. So from that perspective, I thought, I also thought he would have been a great pick because I think he's only scratching the surface as far as his potential as a pass rusher. But ultimately, you move back three spots and you pick up Vince Beagle, who rushed the passer on the other side, who I think is better equipped to contribute on day one. Just I think his tools are a little more refined as a pass rusher, and I think certainly the trade works out well for the Packers, just overall in filling two needs with that one 29th pick.
The other position that I wasn't surprised that the Packers addressed during the draft, Tex, was running back, and I was just a little bit surprised that they waited so long. I mean, there were some other running backs around the board at that point. There was still Dalvin Cook was still available as a big name, even Joe Mixon. Were you surprised that the Packers waited so long to go after a running back? And who do you really see kind of emerging from those guys that they drafted, or even potentially Ty Montgomery keeping the job?
Yeah, I was not surprised at all that they waited. Generally, Thompson does not like to invest a whole lot of draft capital in running backs. You saw it with Lacy a couple of years ago when, you know, he was mostly touted as kind of a first round pick, and then he falls all the way down into the 60s, and at that point Ted had to scoop him up. But I think they definitely did consider Cook very heavily at 33. I think they just figured that the value was a little better, that that they could that they had a really good player in King at that spot, and that's why they went in that direction instead. So as far as the guys that they got, again, it's Jamal Williams, Aaron Jones. Devontae Mays is kind of a bowling ball in the seventh round. I don't know how much you'll see out of him. I really like the tandem of Williams and Jones. And what I think you could see out of the Packers a little bit this year is kind of a New England Patriots approach to the running back position. You've got three guys with the two of them and Ty Montgomery who have kind of different all different running styles, different body types. And I think that's gonna lend themselves to really playing the matchups. You're gonna see Mike McCarthy draw up specific things for each of these players, and I think all three of them, I think, are gonna see significant time. Ultimately, I think Montgomery's still gonna be the guy. This offseason, he's really been talking about how excited he is about the running back position and making that switch midseason last year. Now he's got a full offseason to really learn the nuances of the position. So he's got a build that I think really works well there. I mean, he's 6'2", 216. He's built like a running back, not a receiver. So I do think he's going to be the perfect kind of running back for the Packers offense, a guy who can catch the ball out of the backfield. You can move him all around the formation. The question on him is going to be pass blocking, but if he can get that under control and do a decent job with that, I think you've got a pretty complete back in Montgomery and some good role players as far as the running backs go in the draft.
But the biggest question is, did he change his number yet?
No, he didn't, and he's not going to, much to the chagrin of Andy Benoit of Sports Illustrated and some other people. But we've kind of enjoyed picking on people for getting up in arms about this, because he found a precedent somewhere back in the, I think, the 70s of a guy for the Chargers who switched from tight end to running back and kept number 82. And so He did his homework. He looked it back into the history books, found a guy, and found the loophole in the rule book that says, yeah, if you change positions but stay on the same team, you don't need to change your numbers. So that's how he's getting away with it. And I know it looks weird, but meh, I'm cool with it.
He can do one better if he changes his name to Ty Ocho Ocho. I'll be fine with that if he does that. But the number's still going to bother me to no end.
It's going to be weird for sure, but I, at least as Packers fans, seeing it every week, we'll get used to it. I think it's opposing teams fans for sure that'll struggle with it.
Now, speaking, let's move on to free agency, which sounds like an oddball to say about the Packers. Usually when we're talking about free agency, we're talking about who they let go and who they lock up, pretty much. And while Eddie Lacy does hit the road, and I can no longer make the mobile cheeseburger jokes, Ted Thompson really went out for the tight end position. Not only getting Martellus Bennett, Super Bowl champion Martellus Bennett, off the streets for only, I think, like $3.8 million cap hit in 2017. Yep. But they also picked up a Rams tight end, Lance Kendricks. So, like, you know, obviously overhauling the tight end position, which, you know, we talked for years and years and years. The tight end position has always been one of those positions we keep saying it's evolving, and I think we keep saying that without really, it's been evolving for, in my mind, decades. We've been trying to figure out how to get good guys to just take these passes. But how are the Packers really looking to use this position going forward, given that they just spent a lot of money getting two guys to upgrade the position?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a focus of this offense, and McCarthy has said time and time again that he really values players who can attack the middle of the field. And whether that's a receiver or a tight end, you can do that in a lot of different ways. I mean, Jordy Nelson is an example of a guy who you can attack the middle of the field with when he's split out wide. You know, Randall Cobb attacks the middle from the slot, but what the Packers haven't really had until, at least in recent years, was that big physical field stretching tight end, and Bennett certainly brings that to the table. Kendricks is a guy, he's a little bit more of a move tight end. I think you'll see him shifting around the formation a lot, maybe playing a little bit of H-back, some fullback. But I think you'll see a lot of two tight end sets this year, and that's something the Packers just haven't used in the last couple of years. They've been so focused on their three wide, one tight end, one running back formation, and sometimes I think to the detriment of the offense overall. And so you're going to see a lot more of Bennett and Kendricks together on offense together. They're both good blockers. Bennett's a great blocker. So I think that allows McCarthy to be a little more creative as far as how he uses those guys, calling passes, calling runs with both players on the field. And I think your point about the evolution of tight ends is a good one, because for the last maybe 5 or 10 years, five or 6 years, I guess, you've kind of looked at more of the Jimmy Graham type, the physical, or the taller receiver type of tight end. And I think you're starting to see a little bit more of a shift towards the big physical guys who can also get down the field and catch passes. And that, I think, is what Bennett brings. He's really the all-around package, and it's going to be a great help for this offense.
And then I think I'm trying to find whatever other notes here. Mostly I just got notes as far as guys leaving. Like, you did, again, a lot of the signings beyond the tight end were just re-upping a lot of other guys. And then you see Julius Peppers, and I mentioned Eddie Lacy. Both of them hit the road. TJ Lang is out. JC Treader is out. But who else would you say was probably of either the re-signs or the new signings? Who's probably, like, the biggest name that we can say for the Packers? Is it one of those tight ends? Is it Martellus Bennett, or is it someone else?
Yeah, I mean, Bennett's definitely the biggest splash. Re-signing Nick Perry, the outside linebacker, was definitely a big get. Once the franchise tags came down, he kind of was one of the top pass rushers in the market. So being able to bring him back and pair him with Clay Matthews again is really key, because with Peppers and Dayton Jones leaving, there's really not a whole lot of depth at the outside linebacker position. There's a couple other, kind of lower name guys that don't maybe get the attention that they should as far as the signings. But in addition to getting Bennett, Ted Thompson did a great job in getting some role players in there. He got Jari Evans from New Orleans to help replace DJ Lang. He picked up Devon House again, coming back to Green Bay from Jacksonville after he was kind of miscast in the zone scheme. And then there's one or two other names in there. Ricky Jean-Francois from Washington to help out on the defensive line. So I think it's a combination of getting the big signings with Bennett and bringing Perry back, and then role players in smart areas where they definitely need a little bit of veteran help on the depth side of things. And just overall, I think it was a great offseason in free agency for the Packers, which is not something you hear very often.
You mentioned the Packers picking up Jari Evans, which I thought was an interesting signing. He is a veteran. He's been in the league for over, 10, 11 years now. So he does provide some stability. Do they plan on him starting out of the gate, or are they going to go with Don Barclay on the right side?
Every Packers fan will tell you they are praying to the Lord that Jari Evans is the starter at right guard. He will be. It's pretty much a foregone conclusion that Evans is going to be the starter. I think they've looked at him as a one-year stopgap until one of the younger guys can take control of a starting job. Lane Taylor did a good job filling in for Josh Sitton last year. He was at least an average starter to above average, in my opinion. Evans kind of buys him the time on the right side to develop a guy like Kyle Murphy, a pick last year, Kofi Amicia, who's a sixth round pick this year. One of these young guys, I think they're expecting them to take a jump in 2018 and take over that job. But Barclay is really just kind of a jack of all trades. He's a great guy to have on your roster as a backup to all five positions, but you don't really ever want him starting for a significant period of time.
Okay, and the player that the Lions want to have starting for a significant period of time is obviously TJ Lang. So what do you think he's going to bring to Detroit's offense that has sort of been missing? Like, what element do you think he's going to bring that is going to best, make his time in Detroit worthwhile?
Well, there's two things that always strike me about TJ Lang. One is when he gets on the field, he's got a nasty demeanor, and he's really kind of going to bring an edge, I think, to that offensive line. I'm not familiar enough with the Lions line to kind of know the attitudes of those guys, but that's certainly something I think he'll bring to that room. And the other is just he is a magnificent pass blocker when he's healthy. So if he can get his ankles and knees right, I know he's had a little bit of issues in the last year. Maybe it was the hip. I'm blanking now. Yeah, but if he's right and he's ready to go, he is as good a pass blocking guard as you'll find in the NFL. And certainly that'll help with keeping Matthew Stafford upright when there's pressure coming from the interior.
I kind of want to get your perspective on how the whole contract situation thing rolled out with TJ Lang, because I know the Packers kind of, at least reports out there, the Packers kind of offered him a what some people called an insultingly low contract, and then the Lions threw a last-minute contract to outbid Seattle, and I think a lot of people think maybe they overpaid for someone, especially that is kind of going through all those injuries you just mentioned. What's your outlook on it? Do you think the Lions overpaid? Are you upset that the Packers didn't necessarily put in a more respectable offer? Is that even how you see it, how it played out?
Yeah, I think what the Packers tend to do is they lowball early, and then once a player kind of tests his market, they will determine whether or not they're willing to match that offer. And they've kind of developed that relationship with a lot of these players' agents to to know that that's kind of how they operate. I think that's kind of what they did with Lang. And then once he got those offers from Seattle and Detroit, they just decided, you know what, we're not willing to invest that kind of money in a 29-year-old guard who has had some hip issues. And so I don't think, especially once the Evans signing came down, I think that really settled everybody down. You know, we didn't have Don Barkley penciled in as a starter. So suddenly you've got a former Pro Bowler, former All-Pro there, you know, even though he's an older player, penciled in as your starter, I think that helps a little bit. But just fundamentally, I think that price tag wasn't something the Packers were willing to go to. And as far as I'm concerned, I think that money was well spent in free agency to bring in Evans, to bring in House, to bring in Jean-Francois, to fill a couple other holes and then work on developing those interior linemen for the future.
And how confident are you that the Packers have that kind of future guard on the roster right now? Is it just kind of like cross your fingers at this point, or is there real development there happening for the future?
Yeah, because yeah, I thought Forrest Lamp would have been even in consideration mm-hmm. there at the beginning of the second round when they moved back to 33.
Yeah, you and a lot of other people too. It certainly would have made sense. The Evans signing actually happened the day before the draft, if I recall right. So that kind of helped buy them a little bit of time. I do think it's kind of a coin flip at this point with some of these guys. You're looking at a 6th-round pick in Amichia, a 7th-round pick in Kyle Murphy, and an undrafted free agent in Lucas Patrick, who are kind of your guards of the future, so to speak. And so banking on any one of those guys is going to be kind of a crapshoot. I think you're hoping for one of those three to develop, to turn into something down the road, and hopefully again by 18 maybe they'll make something of themselves to the point where you're comfortable starting. If you're telling me to put my money on one of them, I'd honestly probably go with Amichia, just because he was, I think, the best athlete by spark in this year's offensive line class. So he's a terrific athlete. He needs to put on a little weight to play some guard, but I think he's got the highest ceiling of any of those players. But yeah, certainly it doesn't leave with a whole lot of confidence right now as far as what we've seen of those players so far. You just really haven't seen anything out of any of them. So it's tough to really feel too good about that moving forward. And I wouldn't be surprised if Evans does play and plays healthy this year, maybe they see him re-up Evans for one more season.
All right. And last question here before we let Tex go, probably the biggest offseason change that we haven't even talked about yet. New York Post, April 12th. Why Aaron Rodgers dumped controlling Olivia Munn. People Magazine.
<no.
laughs> Aaron Rodgers, Olivia Munn won't keep in touch. U.S. Magazine. Why Olivia Munn and Aaron Rodgers called it quits. No, I'm joking. No one cares. Like,
thank you.
I'm joking. Completely joking about this. No one gives a shit. And I look forward to a lot of sportsmen sportsing us, telling us why it is important or something, or looking at Aaron Rodgers, like, yeah.
I do have one real question, if you wouldn't mind before jumping off. We're getting into, like, prediction season. We're seeing a lot of prediction models, all that sort of stuff, and obviously Packers are pretty much leading the way in every NFC North prediction you see out there. Who do you see? Do you see the Vikings coming up as their main competition, or do you still think it's the Lions right now?
So I'm a little torn on that. I think both teams are probably going to be neck and neck as far as the division race goes. You know, certainly I see both of those teams finishing around or above 500. If I have to give an edge to one side or the other, I do really like what the Lions did with their draft this year. And certainly, you know, adding Lang to the interior of that offensive line is going to be a big help. So if you're betting on which of those two is going to finish higher, I'm going with Detroit, and not just because I'm talking to you guys.
We're flattered, though, Tex.
Very flattered. Tex Western, everyone. You can find him on Twitter at
Tex Western.
At Tex Western. Yes, thank you. That is Acme Packing Company from SB Nation that he represents. And no pack, no. But Tex, thank you very much for joining with us today.
Thanks, guys. Go Pack, go.
Jeez. Oh, all right, we'll
be here. We can edit that out in post-production.
Yeah, we'll cut it out in post. Yeah, yeah.
Mail time!
The mail's here!
Here's the mail, it never fails. It makes me want to wag my tail. When it comes, I want to wail.
Mail time! Hashtag AskPOD on Twitter at any point, usually on Mondays, when we want your questions for our mailbag or drop them off on the AskPOD article that goes up Mondays, again, on prideofdetroit.com. I don't know when we're ever going to move to Sunday, but this is where the mailbag is right now. We need to figure out what's going to happen with this during the season, too. Like, we want to be faster with y'all. Doesn't feel fair during the season when it comes out on a Tuesday, but we'll figure something out. I don't know why I'm rambling. You know what? I'm killing time here. Jeremy. So, Jeremy...
I'm rubbing my hands together. I want to get to this segment here.
We have a problem in that we said...
No, we don't have a problem. Jeremy has a problem. He made it into a problem, and then he came up with his own damn resolution to it.
And it
Which
fucking
worked.
Which worked. You damn bastard. We have 8 new reviews. We're not going to get to all of them today, but we have them all in here. I'm capping us at 2 a week. So there. Jeremy, you have 4 weeks. Does that cover us through SummerSlam, Ryan?
No, not quite.
All right, end of time.
We do cover over Money in the Bank, though. So.
Get
to your questions. Get to your questions before I start talking about loot.
So, yeah, we're going to talk about loot. No, we're going to talk about the first 2 reviews of the 8 that we got. Thank you to everyone who did. We're going to lift our terroristic demands for 4 weeks while we get through these reviews. So, our first 5-star... All of these were 5-star reviews, by the way. So, good on everybody.
Perfect.
First one comes from your boy Rob. And he's the first, I think, to use emojis in his review, which I'm glad we've passed that threshold. The title of his review is Great in All Caps, followed by 3 fire emojis. He says, can't lie, I really enjoy listening to Yule. Didn't think I would be turning into a podcast on a podcast weekly on the regular. Keep it up. Oh, and enough wrestling talk. 2 exclamation points. I roll from Ryan Matthews. Second.
No. You're not here to narrate the things that go on in the podcast.
Oh,
just
not,
read.
Okay.
Not a visual medium.
All right. This is an interesting review. Next, comes from CSC Slyless 76. The title of his review is Blackmailed, and it reads, "Jesus Christ, will you guys just quit begging for reviews already? I mean, come on. I was really getting around to leaving that glowing review when you thought punishing your listeners into submission was a good idea. Now you get this instead." Oh, you mean that 5-star review that I actually got you to write? Yes, we did. Thank you so much.
You weren't really going to write that. I know. You guys are slackers. We got to whip you into shape now and then.
So thanks to those 2 and the rest of you who will get around to the next week. Keep them coming, though, guys. You know, if you want to stave off the wrestling talk for more weeks, keep them coming.
SummerSlam holds over your head like the Sword of Damocles.
It's fine for your future spinoff podcast.
I'm not promising anything for a spinoff. I'm sure. Let's get to the questions. Holy God, we've spent way too much time on this. All right. Where do you guys want to start here? Because I've got some... Let's start with Joseph R. Sweeney 5, who asks us, what would your top 5 football announcers be? And he split this off into 2 categories, into play-by-play and color.
Ooh, I don't know
about some of your...
I don't think I could give 5 right off the cuff there. That's kind of a high demand there.
Yeah. I mean, you have to dip into some, like, B-teams there, right? Or go into guys who are retired, but...
Yeah, I mean, guys that I want to see on my broadcast, and did he say football? All right, well, if I'm talking about guys I want to see on the broadcast, I feel like I have to answer this in terms of teams. So, give me Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth as my number 1 team, and... It came, yeah, I think Chris was telling me about the news last week that Tirico is going to join Collinsworth for Thursday night games, which I'm excited about because Tirico is just as good, if not better, than Al Michaels. And then
bite your tongue.
I think it's true. At this point in their careers, maybe not Al Michaels at his peak. And then like, I'm sorry, Gus Johnson doing anything. Love it.
Now, I don't have much color on the way here because I mean, some color guys are all right. Like, I think my favorite wouldn't be Chris Collinsworth, it'd be Gary Danielson for the for CBS SEC football. But I mean, Chris Collinsworth's up there too, but I generally veer towards play-by-play because maybe that's just what I like. I like play-by-play guys. So number one overall, and sadly just retired, but is a legend in football and golf and basketball. The man did everything, but Vern Lundquist is my number one. Because just listen to him yell, "Oh my goodness," and chuckle and chortle and everything else. I know his history is mostly Dallas Cowboys in the NFL, but he is a man. He was one of those old class, he's probably the last that old class of football broadcasters who would go and just get hammered and liquored up before the game and then call it anyway. We've lost a Titan here. He goes on to chortle elsewhere.
Just imagine what he would have been like at that Nashville game where they just handed out mini bottles of Jack to everyone who was in the press box.
He'd be drinking that on the air. He'd have.
He
no
would
shame.
Have gotten there early and just taken everybody's Jack.
That's true. That would have been great. Man, I don't really. I'm trying to rank these after Vern. So this is where it starts to get rough. So I would say best in the NFL right now is Mike Tirico. Like, he's everything right now. I'm sorry, I don't feel much about Al Michaels anymore. Just some guys age well, Al Michaels didn't. Mike Tirico is everything. And I cannot wait for him to finally come and snatch that crown for Sunday Night Football. And he will do that very, very soon. Three, I'm going to dip back into college. This one is still among us, but still one of the old timers. Brent Musburger.
He retired.
Did he finally retire? That's Sly Old Fox.
He did.
Goddamn. You are looking live.
I think he retired doing a Kentucky basketball game this year. That was the last game that he called.
He called a basketball game? I did not know he calls basketball, but I mean, Brent was a legend for a long time. Like, one of the first studio shows out there, too. The NFL on CBS.
Yes, sir.
And then, let's see here, Gus Johnson, after that, I mean, insanely good. What else can we say? I really wish he would start doing NFL again. And then, let's see, I'm at four, so I think five. I'm going to go retired. I'm going to go Keith Jackson.
I'll give my top five real quick. Number one, I'll go with Mike Tirico, because I guess I can agree with you guys at this point in their career. I think Tirico's ahead of Michaels, but Al Michaels has the greatest call of all time. The 1980 Olympic U.S. hockey team. Two, I would say, would be Al Michaels. Three, I'm going Gus Johnson. Gus Johnson's four. Number three is Kevin Harlan. That's a name that nobody really mentioned, but he does CBS games. He is good, and he's obviously infamous for the LeBron James with no regard for human life. and I don't know, put whoever you want. I'll put Dennis Miller number five.
GB42 asks us, has Wonder Woman saved the DCEU? So that'd be the DC Comics Expanded Universe, which, I mean, is it just at this point, those movies are what? Batman versus Superman, Suicide Squad, and Wonder Woman?
And Man of Steel.
Is Man of Steel technically part of that? Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, Batman vs. Superman was technically a Man of Steel sequel, but Batman got top billing, because we all see how important Superman is in 2017.
So these are mostly, like, Dan Snyder-written films.
Zack Snyder?
Zack Snyder. God damn it. Zack Snyder, who, by the way, Zack Snyder did have a writing credit on Wonder Woman before everyone goes out and praises it.
Did Dan Snyder do the... Does Wonder Woman fight some Redskins?
This is terrible.
This is terrible. Awful. Why'd I even take this question?
I've yet to see Wonder Woman yet.
Am I the only one here who's seen it?
Let me be honest, guys. I need to be upfront with you. I have not gone to see a superhero film Since I went to go see Batman vs. Superman four times in theaters.
Still broken.
Still broken.
I thought it was like three at most. Ryan, you are broken.
I am broken. It changed me. I didn't even want to...
Broken Ryan.
Delete. Delete.
Delete.
Let's keep that to ourselves, Chris. But yeah, no, the Batman vs. Superman, it just crumbled me.
It just ruined your faith in comic book movies, hasn't it?
Yeah. Wow, I am having a revelation on air right now, and this is really getting to me. I have not watched a superhero movie since then.
Look, as someone who's seen it, like, everyone's gonna say it's very good, and like, as a comic book movie, I agree, but it's okay. All comic books, especially DC, are reactionary at heart, and I've even seen people accuse DC way back in the past being fascist, too. Which, I mean, anytime you're dealing with stories about characters that hold, like, all this power in their hands, you're going to get those kind of responses to them. But Wonder Woman, man, how that was executed, I could see Zack Snyder's hand in, because it was... What's the word I'm looking for? Wagnerian. It was Wagnerian. It reminded me way too much of like Siegfried and Gotter Dammerung in how the story was oriented and how it deals with concepts of basically superhumans and superhuman heroes and humans. And it unnerved me in quite a few ways. And I don't know. I'm trying to psych myself up into actually writing something and see if I can pitch it somewhere and not get laughed at about it, but it was a good movie, and it also unnerved me in a very unsteady way. Mm. Maybe I'm reading way too much.
Do you have an answer to the original question? Do you think this gives you hope for the rest of?
I mean, Marvel? No, because I think this is more just the place Wonder Woman is at, because. It definitely fulfilled that role. It's a very long-standing feminist icon, and a lot of the press is focused on what Wonder Woman means to that you know, movement, to women comic book fans, to, you know, little girls who, you know, I mean, rightfully so. You know, I've always heard tales of, like, you know, girls growing up wondering if there's a, you know, superhero from them, and then finally they learn about Wonder Woman. That's absolutely legitimate. And that's why representation kind of matters for comic book movies. But I don't know if this saves this, because I think this is a phenomena that is localized to Wonder Woman itself. Justice League, I'm expecting to come around, and I don't know if Ryan ever goes back and sees a movie again, but if he does, this will probably break him again. Shamu S2D2 asks us, I've been living in Tennessee now. Okay, I'm going to skip past all this stuff just because it was a question. If you could only make it to one regular season game in person this year, which one would you choose?
If I could only make it to one regular season game. So
is this at home or is it?
Could, yeah, I was going to say, could it be home or away?
Sure.
Let's. I think we've done this one away, but I think we've done the question about away before. I think most of us said it was going to be New Orleans. So why don't we do at home?
I'd say you have to circle that Sunday night game against the Steelers at home, because I mean, we were just talking about how the environment at Ford Field can get real rowdy, and you know, what better time to do that during a Sunday night game? I mean, the only other option is potentially, I would say, maybe the Packers game to end the season, but that's only if there are stakes involved.
I would say no anyway, because if they lose that game, your New Year's Eve this is going to be completely ruined.
Or that just means you get the drinking starting. It would ruin it, because the drinking would start pretty early. The drinking would start pretty early. The heavy drinking would start pretty early. My answer is actually, I'm looking at that Sunday, September 24th, week 3 against the Falcons. Hopefully that game, there's like 80 points scored at least.
I'm surprised you're not going with November 12th.
I think that would be a blast. Now, I was going to get to November 12th. I could never go to that game because I would be so personally conflicted.
Get out of here.
Which team would I be cheering for when they made their way into the end zone?
My answer is Thanksgiving. It's always Thanksgiving.
That's a fun tradition that I miss out on.
Evan at Big Slick McDick, friend of the show.
Yes.
What is the absolute worst plant? He offers grass, high maintenance, basically worthless. I don't know about that. You can lay down on grass.
I don't know. Like, But when you lay in grass, you get pretty itchy.
I never do.
I'd say
that might be
those
a
weeds that are
know.
Usually like yeah. the leaves are kind of triangle shaped, but they're all like serrated on the sides. They usually go very close to the ground. If you ever like walk.
Is that like a type of dandelion or what?
Do they like pop up like in between sidewalk cracks? Yeah. I mean, those are obviously pretty useless because what purpose do they serve other than to just be weeded out or become like the inspiration for a Tupac Shakur poem?
I can't really say dandelions because you can cook dandelions. You can cook dandelion leaves and shit.
I'm not overblowing a dandelion in the fall. I'm not too old for that.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I completely forgot about that.
What about arugula? I just, like, it's a cool name, but at the same time, I hate it. I hate the name. Is that a plant?
It is a plant. Isn't that, like, a type of lettuce?
Yeah. Us in Cali know that.
No, you know what it is? These goddamn oak trees that are outside my, outside here that are, like, getting sap all over my car. Just coming down from the leaves and the branches overhead, and it's getting on the windshield, and I can't get it off, even though, like, I will go and wash my car, and, like, every goddamn, like, piece of bird shit on the roof of my car that gets covered in the sap gets preserved there. This motherfucking oak
tree. You got, like, a Jurassic Park situation with bird shit. Years from now, we can extract bird shit DNA.
Welcome to Bird Shit Park.
Let me tell you the most useful plant. And it's the one that manufactures cars that are full of cylinders, baby. Car plants are the most useful plants there are.
I don't think you know a lot about arborology. Is that a thing?
Chris Lyles asks us, fuck, marry, kill. Martha Ford, Don Muehlbach, Jay Gerudock.
Nope. I'm not answering this question.
Okay, next question then. Okay, we'll completely... One Pride asks us top five best rappers of all time. Ryan,
you have the floor.
All right. Number one with a bullet is Jay-Z. He's got too long of a track record. Now, a lot of people argue that he went way too commercial, but let me argue against anybody who thinks like Tupac or Biggie should be number one. Like, we don't have a large enough body of work. Tupac has a little bit more work, but I'm going to have to say something about Tupac real quick. Tupac's, like, kind of overrated.
Oh, boy. Wait. Before you get to your next one, Jay-Z's, that's Beyonce's wife, or husband, right?
Yeah, that's Beyonce's husband. Okay. That's the father of Beyonce's child and her two unborn children.
Now I know who you're talking about.
Now you understand? Okay,
I mean, I would even say, like, even if you, like, cut Jay-Z off after Black Album when he was supposed to be done, that's still a pretty good body of work right there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to even be considered in the top five, you have to submit a holy trilogy. So you have to have three albums that you would consider like classics. And he definitely has three. Reasonable Doubt, Blueprint, and Black Album.
Okay. I like that. Yeah.
Number two, I'm going to go with Andre 3000. I love me some Andre 3000. He's also better known as the better half of Outkast, which is kind of overblown because Big Boy's an incredible rapper in his own right. But Andre 3000 is just on another planet, like literally. Number three, I'm doing this off the top of my head right now. I have a list somewhere that I always update every once in a while. But number three, I would have to say, for me personally, it's Redman. A lot of people like relegate Redman as just being like a weed rapper. That's fine because like he's better than any other weed rapper has ever been. But Redman is just so eclectic, and there would be no Slim Shady persona to Eminem if there wasn't a Redman first and foremost. Like if you listen, I mean, like Redman's got What the Album, he's got Dare is a Dark Side, and he's got Muddy Waters. So there's your trilogy right there, and those were his first three albums. So like, I mean, he knocked everyone out of the park. And he doesn't perform any of the songs from Dare is a Dark Side anymore because he was doing way too much PCP. And he says he was just in like way too dark of a place. He was doing like G-Funk samples and turning them inside and out. And just listen to that album if you ever want to have an incredible experience. Number four, I'm going to go with Biggie. Yeah, I know he only has two albums, but those two albums I can put up against anybody else's two albums and... the difference is negligible.
And then number five, if I don't include Eminem, am I like really from Detroit?
I think you can leave Eminem out. I think he is way overblown.
Like, technically, like, he's
great.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Everyone's like, he's great technically. Like, what does that mean? Why does that matter? Why are we, like, you know, get the whole body of work. Not just say, well, he's great technically. And I like Eminem. I like the Eminem show. But I don't know. I if you want to leave him off, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I mean, he does have a trilogy. He has Slim Shady LP, Marshall Mathers LP, and Eminem Show. But, like, honestly, after that, outside of Relapse, which is, like, my favorite thing that he's done since Eminem Show, like, everything has largely been, like, meh.
Yeah.
So, my number five is actually Ice Cube.
Josh LaFon, the enemy of the show, asks us, Jesse Camp, Ryan Seacrest, Simon Cowell, and Gordon Ramsay are fighting in a to the death in a steel cage match. Who wins?
Wait, was Guy Fieri in this battle?
No, Guy Fieri was not in this battle.
Guy Fieri runs in. No,
cashes in money in the bank.
Guy Fieri cashes in his money in the bank and lays waste to everybody. And he doesn't even wait until there's just like two people left, or just like the one person celebrating in the ring. He just cashes in at the beginning of the match. He's like, I want to insert myself in this match. Little diner drive-ins and dives.
I'm gonna dine,
Triple D,
drive
baby.
In and I'm gonna dine, drive in, and dive on you.
That's his finishing move, is the Triple D.
The Triple D.
I feel like Gordon Ramsay would put up a good fight, but then somebody would.
Gordon,
like,
Ramsay's just a shit talker. He doesn't know how to fight.
He would be great on the mic, but the thing is I feel like some concession food would catch his eye and he would be so appalled at it that would be his downfall. Who else? Who else? I heard Gordon Ramsay. Who else?
Jesse Camp and Simon Cowell.
Oh, Jesse Camp. Poor guy. He's a rail. He would get destroyed.
He'd be demolished. We had that picture of him for that one podcast. He looks like he weighs no more than like 120.
Yeah, but he's like 6'5".
Barring the Guy Fieri running, I'm going to go with Ryan Seacrest. He's
like 5'6".
Seacrest out.
Is he? But I mean, okay.
Seacrest out.
Seacrest.
Guy Fieri,
okay,
is the only answer to this, man. The
it
dude,
really is.
Like Action Bronson said, the dude has frosted tips in 2017. How can you not love him and his chances to win a steel cage deathmatch?
Forgive me for a second, listeners. Is Guy Fieri and Scott Steiner the same person?
We don't know. He could be.
We don't actually know. This is a great way to find out. All right, I think we're done here. Thank you all for listening to the Friday Detroit podcast. This mailbag's gone on way too long and has gotten way too weird. And Ryan wants to watch something here at 8 o'clock. It's the NFL top players countdown again.
Tonight. Matthew Stafford.
You guys will already know it by the time you're listening.
Yep. All right, see y'all next time.